that he hadn't meant it, that he would have crawled. This man, this noble and selfless and remarkable man. Irene dragged her hands around his shoulders, fingers slipping into his silken brown hair. More, more, more. But his kiss was thorough, as if he wanted to learn every taste, every angle of her. She brushed her tongue against his, and his growl had her toes curling in her slippers. She felt the tremor go through him, before she registered what it was. The strain. Still, he kissed her, seemed intent to do so, even if it brought him crashing to the floor. Small steps. Small measures. Irene broke away, putting a hand on his chest when he made to claim her mouth again. You should sit. His eyes were wholly black.
Let me. Please, Irene.
Each word was a broken rasp, as if he'd freed some tether on himself. She fought to keep her breathing steady, to gather her wits. Too long on his feet and he might strain his back. And before she could encourage the walking and more, she needed to go into his wound to look around. Perhaps it had receded enough on its own. Kaol brushed his mouth against hers, the silken heat of his lips enough to make her willing to ignore common sense. But she shoved back against it, gently slid out of his reach. Now I'll have ways to reward you, she said, trying for humor. He didn't smile back, didn't do anything but watch her with near predatory intent as she backed away a step and offered her arm to him, to walk back to the chair. To walk. He was walking. He did so, pushed off the wall and swayed. Irene caught him, steadied him.
I thought you never stepped in to help me, he said dryly, raising a brow.
In the chair, yes. You have much farther to fall now. Kaol huffed a laugh, then leaned in to whisper in her ear.
Will it be the better the couch now, Irene?
She swallowed, daring a sidelong look up at him. His eyes were still dark, his face flushed and lips swollen.
From her.
Irene's blood heated, her core near molten. How the hell would she have him nearly naked before her now? You are still my patient, she managed to say primly, and guided him into his chair. Nearly shoved him onto it, and nearly leaped atop him too. And while there is no official vow about such things, I plan to keep things professional. Kaol's answering smile was anything but. So was the way he growled,
Come here.
Irene's heartbeat pounded through every inch of her, as she closed the foot of space between them, as she held his burning gaze and settled into his lap. His hand slid beneath her hair to cup the back of her neck, drawing her face to his as he brushed a kiss over the corner of her mouth, then the other. She gripped his shoulder, fingers digging into the hard muscle beneath, her breathing turning jagged as he nipped at her bottom lip, as his other hand began to explore up her torso. A door opened in the hallway, and Irene was instantly up, striding across the sitting room for the desk, to the vials of oil there, just as Kaja slipped through the door, a tray in her hands. The servant girl had found the ingredients Irene needed. Twine, goat's milk, and vinegar. Irene could barely remember words to thank the servant as the girl set the tray on the desk. Whether Kaja saw their faces, their hair and clothes, and could read the white-hot line of tension between them, she said nothing. Irene had no doubt she might suspect, would no doubt report it to whoever held her leash. But Irene found herself not caring as she leaned against the desk. Kaja departing as silently as she had come, found Kaol still watching her, chest heaving. What do we do now? Irene asked quietly, for she didn't know how to go back. Kaol didn't reply. He just stretched out one leg wholly in front of him, then the other, did it again, marveling.
We don't look back, he said, meeting her stare. It helps no one and nothing to look back.
The way he said it, It seemed as if it meant something more. To him, at least. But Kaol's smile grew, his eyes lighting as he added,
"We can only go on."
Irene went to him, unable to stop herself, as if that smile were a beacon in the dark. And when Kaol wheeled himself to the couch and peeled off his shirt, when he lay down and she set her hands on his warm, strong back, Irene smiled as well. Chapter 40. Standing and walking a few steps wasn't the same as being back to full capacity. The next week proved it. Irene still battled with whatever lurked in Kaol's spine, still clinging down to the very base, she explained, and still keeping him from full motion. Running, most jumping, kicking, out of the question. But thanks to the sturdy wooden cane she procured for him, he could stand, and he could walk. And it was a God's damned miracle. He brought the cane and the chair to his morning training with Hashim and the guards. For the moments when he pushed himself too hard and couldn't manage the return trip to his rooms. Irene joined him during the early lessons, instructing Hashim on where to focus in his legs, to rebuild more muscle, to stabilize him further. She'd done the same for Shen, Hashim had confided one morning, had come to supervise most of his initial training sessions after his injury. So Irene had been there, watching from the sidelines. That first day, Kaol had taken up a sword against Hashim and dueled, or did it as best he could with the cane in one hand. His balance was shit, his legs unreliable, but he managed to get in a few good hits against the man. And a cane. Not a bad weapon, if the fight called for it. Irene's eyes had been wide as saucers when they stopped, and Kaol approached her spot on the wall, leaning heavily on the cane as his body trembled. The color on her face, he realized with no small amount of male satisfaction, was from far more than the heat. And when they'd eventually left, walking slowly into the cool shadows of the halls, Irene had tugged him into a curtained-off alcove and kissed him. Leaning against a supply shelf for support, his hands had roved all over her, the generous curves and small waist, tangling into her long, heavy hair. She'd kissed and kissed him, breathless and panting, and then licked, actually licked, the sweat from his neck. Kaol had groaned so loudly that it was no surprise a servant appeared a heartbeat later, ripping the curtain away, as if to chide two workers for shirking their duties. Irene had blanched, as she'd righted herself, and asked the bowing and scraping male servant not to say anything. He assured her that he wouldn't, but Irene had been shaken. She'd kept her distance for the rest of the walk back, and maintained it every day since. It was driving him mad. But he understood. With her position, both in the Torre and within the palace, they should be smarter, more careful. And with Kaja always in his rooms. Kaol kept his hands to himself, even when Irene laid her own hands upon his back and healed him, pushed and pushed herself to break through that final wall of darkness. He wanted to tell her, debated telling her, that it was already enough. He would gladly live with the cane for the rest of his life. She had given him more than he could ever hope for. For he saw the guards every morning, the weapons and shields. And he thought of that war, unleashing itself at last upon his friends, his homeland. Even if he did not bring an army with him when he returned, he'd find some way to stand on those battlefields. Riding, at least, was now a viable option while fighting alongside them. Fighting for her. He was thinking of it as they walked to dinner one night, over a week later. With the cane, it took him longer than usual, but he did not mind any extra moments spent in her company. She was wearing her purple gown, his favorite, her hair half up and curling softly from the unusually humid day. But she was jumpy, unsettled.
"What is it?"
The royals hadn't cared the first night he'd walked on his own two legs to dinner. Another everyday miracle of the Torre, though the Khagan himself had commended Irene. She'd beamed at the praise.
even as the Coggin had ignored Kaol, as he had done since that ill-fated meeting. Irene rubbed at the scar on her neck as if it ached. He hadn't asked about it, didn't want to know. Only because if he did, even with a war upon them, he might very well take the time to hunt down whoever had done it and bury them.
I convinced Hassar to throw me a party, Irene said quietly.
He waited until they'd passed a cluster of servants before asking,
For what reason?
She blew out a breath.
It's my birthday in 3 days.
Your birthday?
You know, the celebration of the day of your birth.
He nudged her with an elbow, though his spine slipped and shifted with the movement. The cane groaned as he pressed his weight upon it.
I had no idea that she-devils actually had them.
She stuck out her tongue.
Yes, even my kind has them.
Kaol grinned.
So you asked her to throw one for you?
Considering how the last party had gone, he might very well wind up one of those people slipping away into a darkened bedroom.
Especially if Irene wore that dress again. Not exactly, Irene said wryly. I mentioned that my birthday was coming up, and how dull your plans for it were. He chuckled.
Presumptuous of you.
She batted her eyelashes.
And I might have mentioned that in all my years here, I've never been to the desert, and was debating a trip of my own, but that I'd be sad to not celebrate with her.
And I'm guessing that she suggested an oasis owned by her family instead.
Irene hummed.
A little overnight excursion to Oxara. Half a day's ride to the east, to their permanent tented camp within the oasis.
So the healer could scheme after all.
But it'll be boiling in this heat.
The princess wants a party in the desert, so she shall have one.
She chewed on her lip, those shadows dancing again.
I also managed to ask her about it, Oxara.
The history?
Kaol braced himself. Hassar grew bored before she told me much, but she said that she'd once heard that the oasis grew atop a city of the dead, that the ruins now there were merely the gateway inside. They don't like to risk disturbing the dead, so they never leave the spring itself,
to venture into the jungle around it. No wonder she'd seemed concerned.
Not only caves to be found, then.
Perhaps Nusha means something different. Perhaps there are also caves there with information.
She blew out a breath.
I suppose we'll see. I made sure to yawn while Hassar told me, enough that I doubt she'll wonder why I asked at all.
Kaol kissed her temple, a swift brush of his mouth that no one might see.
Clever Irene.
I meant to tell you the other week, but then you stood and I forgot. Some court schemer I am.
He caressed his free hand down the length of her spine.
A bit lower. We've been otherwise engaged.
Her face flushed a beautiful shade of pink, but a thought settled into him.
What do you really want for your birthday? And which one is it?
22. And I don't know. If it wasn't for this, I wouldn't have brought it up at all.
You weren't going to tell me?
She gave him a guilty frown.
I figured that with everything pressing on you, birthdays were inconsequential.
Her hand slid into her pocket, to hold that thing he'd never inquired about. They neared the clamor of dinner in the great hall. He brushed his fingers against hers. She halted at the silent request, the hall spreading away before them, servants and viziers striding past.
Kaol leaned on his cane while they rested, letting it stabilize his weight. Am I invited to this desert party, at least?
Oh, yes, you and all my other favorite people, Argon, Kashin, and a handful of delightful viziers.
I'm glad I made the cut, considering that Hassar hates me.
No.
Irene's eyes darkened.
If Hassar hated you, I don't think you'd be alive right now.
Gods above. This was the woman she'd befriended.
Irene went on.
At least Renya will be there.
But Duva shouldn't be in the heat in her condition, and her husband won't leave her side.
I'm sure that once we get there, information or no, I'll probably wish I could have made a similar excuse.
We've got a few days. We could technically make the same one if we need to leave.
The words settled in. The invitation and implication. Irene's face went delightfully red, and she smacked his arm.
Rogue.
Kael chuckled, and eyed the hallway for a shadowed corner. But Irene breathed,
We can't.
Not about his sorry joke, but about the want she no doubt saw building in his eyes. The want he beheld simmering in hers. He adjusted his jacket.
Well, I'll attempt to find you a suitable present that can compare to an entire desert retreat, but don't hold me to it.
Irene looped her arm through Kael's free one. No more than a healer escorting her patient to the table.
I have everything I need, was all she said.
Chapter 41. It took over a week to plan it. Over a week alone for Sartak and Hulan to dig up ancient maps of the Dagul Fells. Most were vague and useless, what riders had assessed from the air but not dared get too close to detail. The Karen Kui's territory was small, but had grown larger, bolder these last few years. And it was into the dark heart of their territory that they would go. The hardest part was convincing Borte to remain behind. But Nezrin and Sartak left that up to Hulan, and one sharp word from the Hearth Mother had the girl falling in line. Even as Borte's eyes simmered with outrage, she bowed to her grandmother's wishes. As heir, Hulan had snapped, Borte's first obligation was to their people. The bloodline ended with her. Should Borte head into the dim tangle of Dagul, she might as well spit upon where her mother Sulde stood on the slopes of Arundin. Borte had insisted that if she, as Hulan's heir, was to stay, then Sartak, as the Khagan's potential successor, should remain as well. To that, Sartak had merely stalked off into the interior halls of Altun, saying that if being his father's successor meant sitting idly by while others fought for him, then his siblings could have the damn crown. So only the three of them would go. Nezrin and Sartak flying on Kadara, Falcon tucked away as a field mouse in Nezrin's pocket. There had been a final debate last night about bringing a legion. Borte had argued for it, Sartak against it. They did not know how many Karen Kui dwelled in the barren peaks and forested vales between them. They could not risk needlessly losing many lives, and did not have the time to waste on thorough reconnaissance. Three could sneak in, but an army of rooks would be spotted long before they arrived. The argument had raged over the fire pit, but Hulan had settled it. The small company would go, and if they did not return within 4 days, an army would follow. Half a day to fly down, a day to survey the area, a day to go in and then return with the stolen hatchlings. Perhaps even learn what the Fae had feared from the spiders, how they'd fought them. If they were lucky. They'd been flying for hours now, the high wall of the fells growing closer with every flap of Kadara's wings. Soon now they'd cross that first ridge of the Grey Mountains and enter into the spider's territory. Nezrin's breakfast sat heavy in her stomach with each mile closer, her mouth as dry as parchment. Behind her, Sartak had been silent for most of the ride. Falcon dozed in her breast pocket, emerging only now and then to poke out his whiskered snout, sniff at the air, and then duck back inside, conserving his strength while he could. The shifter was still sleeping when Nezrin said to Sartak,
Did you mean what you said last night?
About refusing the crown if it meant not fighting. Sartak's body was a warm wall at her back.
My father has gone to war. All Khagans have. He possesses the ebony and ivory Sulde precisely for that. But if it somehow became the case that I would be denied such things in favor of the bloodline surviving? Yes. A life confined to that court is not what I want.
And yet you are favored to become Khagan one day.
So the rumors say, but my father has never suggested or spoken of it. For all I know, he could crown Duva instead. The gods know she'd certainly be a kind ruler, and is the only one of us to have produced offspring. Nezrin chewed her lip.
Why is it that you haven't married?
She'd never had the nerve to ask, though she'd certainly found herself wondering it during these weeks. Sartak's hands flexed on the reins before he answered.
I've been too busy. And the women who have been presented as potential brides, they were not for me.
She had no right to pry, but she asked,
Why?
Because whenever I showed them Kadara, they either cowered or pretended to be interested in her, or asked just how much time I'd be spending away.
Hoping for frequent absences, or because they'd miss you?
Sartak chuckled.
I couldn't tell. The question itself felt like enough of a leash that I knew they were not for me.
So your father allows you to wed where you will?
Dangerous, strange territory. She waited for him to tease her about it, but Sartak fell quiet.
Yes. Even Duva's arranged marriage. She was all for it. Said she didn't want to have to sort through a court of snakes to find one good man, and still pray he hadn't deceived her. I wonder if there's something to be said for it. She lucked out, anyway. Quiet as he is, her husband adores her. I saw his face the moment they met. Saw hers, too. Relief and something more.
And what would become of them, of their child, if another heir were chosen for the throne?
Nezrin asked carefully.
Why not end this tradition of competing with each other?
Sartak was silent for a long minute.
Perhaps one day, whoever takes the throne will end it. Love their siblings more than they honor the tradition. I like to believe we have moved past who we were centuries ago, when the Empire was still fledgling. But perhaps now, these years of relative peace, perhaps this is the dangerous time.
He shrugged, his body shifting against hers.
Perhaps war will sort the matter of succession for us.
And maybe it was because they were so high above the world,
because that dim land swept ever closer. But Nezrin asked,
There is nothing that would keep you from war if it called then.
You sound as if you are reconsidering this goal of yours to drag us into the north.
She stiffened. I will admit that these weeks here, it was easier before to ask for your aid. When the Rukin were a nameless, faceless legion. When I did not know their names, their families. When I did not know Hulan or Borte. Or that Borte is betrothed.
A low laugh at that. Borte had refused, outright refused, to answer Nezrin's questions about Yaren. She said it wasn't even worth talking about.
I'm sure Borte would be glad to go to war, if only to compete with Yaren for glory on the battlefield.
A true love match, then.
Sartak smiled at her ear.
You have no idea.
He sighed.
It began 3 years ago, this competition between them. Right after her mother died.
His pause was heavy enough that Nezrin asked.
You knew her mother well.
It took him a moment to answer.
I mentioned to you once that I've been sent to other kingdoms to sort out disputes or murmurings of malcontent. The last time my father sent me, I brought a small unit of Rukin along, Borte's mother with them.
Again that heavy quiet.
Nezrin slowly, carefully laid her hand on his forearm that encircled her. The strong muscles beneath the leather shifted, then settled.
It is a long story, and a hard one. But there was violence between the Rukin and the group that sought to bring down our empire. Borte's mother. One of them got in a coward's shot from behind. A poisoned arrow through her neck. Right when we were about to allow them to surrender.
The wind howled around them.
I didn't let any of them walk away after that.
The hollow, cold words said enough.
I carried her body back myself,
Sartak said, the words ripped away by the wind.
I can still hear Borte screaming when I landed in Altoon. Still see her kneeling alone on the slopes of Arundin, after the burial. Clinging to her mother Sulde where it had been planted in the ground.
Nezrin tightened her grip on his arm. Sartak placed his own gloved hand upon hers and squeezed gently as he blew out a long breath.
6 months later, he went on, Borte competed in the Gathering, the annual 3 days of contests and races among all the clans. She was 17 and Yeren was 20, and they were neck and neck for the final great race. As they neared the finish, Yeren pulled a maneuver that might be considered cheating, but Borte saw it coming a mile off and beat him anyway. And then beat him soundly when they landed. Literally. He leaped off his Rook and she tackled him to the ground, pounding his face for the shit he'd pulled that nearly got Arcus killed.
He laughed to himself.
I don't know the particulars of what went on later at the celebration, but I saw him attempt to talk to her at one point, and saw her laugh in his face before walking away. He scowled until they left the next morning, and as far as I know, they didn't see each other for a year. Until the next gathering.
Which Borte won again, Nezrin guessed.
She did indeed. Barely. She pulled the questionable maneuver this time, getting herself banged up in the process, but she technically won. I think Yeren was secretly more terrified of how close she'd come to permanent injury or death, so he let her have the victory. She never told me the particulars of that celebration, but she was shaken for a few days after. We all assumed it was from her injuries, but such things had never bothered her before.
And this year?
This year, a week before the gathering, Yeren appeared at Altun. Didn't see Hulun, or me. Just went right to wherever Borte was in the hall. No one knows what happened, but he stayed for less than 30 minutes from landing to leaving. A week later, Borte won the race again. And when she was crowned victor, Yeren's father stepped up to declare her engagement to his son.
A surprise?
Considering that whenever Borte and Yeren are together, they're at each other's throats, yes. But also a surprise to Borte. She played it off, but I saw them arguing in the hall later. Whether or not she even knew about it or wanted it revealed that way, she still won't say. But she has not disputed the betrothal, though she hasn't embraced it, either. No day has been claimed for the wedding, even though the union would certainly ease our strained ties to the Burlad.
Nezrin smiled a bit. I hope they sort it out.
Perhaps this war will do that for them, too.
Kadara swept closer and closer to the wall of the fells, the light turning thin and cold as clouds passed over the sun. They cleared the towering lip of the first peaks, soaring on an updraft high above, as all of Dagul spread before them.
Holy gods, Nezrin whispered.
Dark gray peaks of barren rock, thin pine trees crusting the vales deep below. No lakes. No rivers, save for the occasional trickling stream, barely visible through the shroud of webbing over all of it. Some webs were thick and white, choking the life from trees. Some were sparkling nets between peaks, as if they sought to catch the wind itself. No life. No hum of insect or cry of beast. No sighing leaves or fluttering wings. Falcon poked his head out of her pocket as they surveyed the dead land below and let out a squeak. Nezrin nearly did the same.
Hulun was not exaggerating, Sartak murmured. They have grown strong.
Where do we even land? Nezrin asked. There's barely a safe spot to be seen. They could have taken the hatchlings and eggs anywhere.
She combed the peaks and valleys for any sign of movement. Any flicker of those sleek black bodies scuttling about. But saw nothing.
We'll make a pass around the territory, Sartak said. Get a sense of the layout, perhaps figure out a thing or two regarding their feeding habits.
Gods above. Keep Kadara high. Fly casual. If we look like we're hunting for something, they might emerge in force.
Sartak whistled sharply to Kadara, who indeed soared higher, faster than her usual ascent, as if glad to rise a little farther from the shrouded territory below.
Stay hidden, friend, Nezrin said to Falcon, her hands shaking as she patted her breast pocket. If they watch us from below, we'd best keep you secret until they least expect it.
Falcon's tiny paws tapped in understanding, and he slid back into her pocket. They flew in idle circles for a time, Kadara occasionally diving as if in pursuit of some eagle or falcon. On the hunt for lunch, perhaps.
That cluster of peaks, Sartak said after a while, pointing toward the highest point of the fells. Like horns spearing toward the sky, two sister peaks jutted up so close to each other, they might have very well once been a single mountain. Between their clawed summits, a shale-filled pass wended away into a labyrinth of stone.
Kadara keeps looking toward it.
Circle it, but keep your distance. Before Sartak could give the order, Kadara obeyed. Something is moving in the pass, Nezrin breathed, squinting.
Kadara flapped closer, nearer to the peaks than was wise.
Kadara,
Sartak warned. But the Rook pumped her wings, frantic, rushing. Just as the thing in the pass became clear. Racing over the shale, bobbing and flapping fuzz-lined wings. A hatchling,
Sartak swore.
Faster, Kadara, faster!
The Rook needed no encouragement. The hatchling was squawking, those two small wings flailing as it tried and failed to lift from the ground. It had broken from the pine trees that flowed right to the edge of the pass, and now aimed for the center of the maze of rock.
Nezrin unslung her bow and knocked an arrow into place, Sartak doing the same behind her.
Not a sound, Kadara,
Sartak warned, just as the Rook opened her beak.
You will alert them.
But the hatchling was screeching, its terror palpable even from the distance. Kadara caught a wind and flew.
Come on, Nezrin breathed, arrow aimed at the woods, at whatever horrors the hatchling had escaped, undoubtedly barreling after it.
The baby Rook neared the broadest part of the pass mouth, balking at the wall of stone ahead, as if it knew that more waited within.
Trapped.
Sweep in, cut through the pass, and sail out.
Sartak ordered the Rook, who banked right, so steeply Nezrin's abdomen strained with the effort to keep in the saddle.
Kadara leveled out, dropping foot by foot toward the hatchling now twisting about, screaming toward the sky as it beheld the Rook rushing in.
Steady,
Sartak commanded.
Steady, Kadara.
Nezrin kept her arrow trained on the labyrinth of rock ahead, Sartak twisting to cover the forest behind. Kadara sailed closer and closer to the shale-coated pass, to the grayish, fuzzy hatchling now holding so still, waiting for the salvation of claws that Kadara unfurled.
30 feet.
20.
Nezrin's arm strained to keep the arrow drawn.
A wind shoved at Kadara, knocking her sideways, the world tilting, light shimmering. Just as Kadara leveled out, just as her talons opened wide to scoop up the hatchling, Nezrin realized what the shimmering was, what the shift in angle revealed ahead.
Look out!
The scream shattered from her throat, but too late. Kadara's talons closed around the hatchling, plucking it up from the ground right as she swept up through the pass peaks, right into the mammoth web woven between them. Chapter 42. The hatchling had been a trap. It was the last thought Nezrin had, as Kadara crashed into the web, the net woven between the two peaks, built not to catch the wind, but Rook's. She only had the sense of Sartak throwing his body into hers, anchoring her into the saddle, and holding tight as Kadara screamed. Snapping and shimmering and rock. Shale and gray sky and golden feathers. Wind howling, the hatchling's piercing cry, and Sartak's bellow. Then twisting, slamming into stone so hard the impact sang through her teeth, her bones. Then falling, tumbling, Kadara's restrained body curving, curving as Sartak was curled over Nezrin, shielding that hatchling in her talons from the final impact. Then the boom. And the bounce. the bounce that snapped the leather straps on the saddle. Still tied to it. They were still tied together as they soared off Kadara's body. Nezrin's bow scattering from her hand, her fingers clasping on open air. Sartak pivoted them, his body a solid wall around hers as Nezrin realized where the sky was, where the pass floor was. He roared as they struck the shale, as he kept her atop him, taking the full brunt of the impact. For a heartbeat, there was only the skittering trickle of shifting shale and the thud of crumbling rock off the pass walls. For a heartbeat, she could not remember where her body was, her breath was. Then a scrape of wing on shale. Nezrin's eyes snapped open, and she was moving before she had the words to name her motions. A cut slashed down her wrist, caked with small rocks and dust. She didn't feel it, barely noticed the blood as she blindly fumbled for the straps to the saddle, snapping them free, panting through her teeth as she managed to lift her head, to dare to look. He was dazed, blinking up at the gray sky, but alive, breathing, blood sliding down his temple, his cheek, his mouth. She sobbed through her teeth, her legs at last coming free, allowing her to roll over to get to his own, to the tangled bits of leather shredded between them. Sartak was half buried in shale, his hands sliced up, but his legs, not broken, he rasped. Not broken. It was more to himself than her. But Nezrin managed to keep her fingers steady as she freed the buckles. The thick riding leathers had saved his life, saved his skin from being flayed off his bones. He'd taken the impact for her, moved her so that he'd hit it first. She clawed at the shale covering his shoulders and his upper arms, sharp rock cutting into her fingers. The leather strap at the end of her braid had come free in the impact, and her hair now fell about her face, half blocking her view of the forest behind and rock around them. Get up, she panted. Get up. He took a breath, blinking furiously. Get up, she begged him. Shale shifted ahead, and a low, pained cry echoed off the rock. Sartak snapped upright. Kadara! Nezrin twisted on her knees, scanning for her bow even as she took in the rook. Lying 30 feet ahead, Kadara was coated in the near-invisible silk. A phantom net, her wings pinned, her head tucked in. Sartak scrambled upright, swaying, slipping on the loose shale as he drew his Asterion knife. Nezrin managed to rise, her legs shaking, head spinning as she scanned and scanned the pass for her bow. There, near the pass wall, intact. She hurtled for it while Sartak ran to the rook, reaching her weapon just as he sliced the first of the webbing free. You'll be fine, he was saying to Kadara, blood coating his hands, his neck. I'll get you out. Nezrin shouldered her bow, pressing a hand to her pocket. Falcon. A little leg pushed against her in answer. Alive. She wasted no time rushing to the rook, drawing her own Feyblade from the sheath Borte had found for her, and slicing at the thick strands. It clung to her fingers, ripping away skin, but she severed and sliced, working her way down the wing as Sartak hacked his way down the other. They reached Kadara's legs at the same time. Saw that her talons were empty. Nezrin's head snapped up, scanning the pass, the piles of disturbed shale. The hatchling had been thrown during the collision. As if even Kadara's talons couldn't keep shut against the pain of impact. The baby rook now lay on the ground near the lip of the pass, struggling to rise, low chirps of distress echoing off the rock. Up, Kadara, Sartak commanded, his voice breaking. Get up! Great wings shifted, shale clacking as the rook tried to obey. Nezrin staggered toward the hatchling, blood unmistakable on its fluffy gray head, its large dark eyes wide with terror and pleading. It happened so fast, Nezrin didn't have time to shout. One heartbeat, the hatchling had opened its beak to cry for help. The next, it screamed, eyes flaring as a long ebony leg emerged from behind a pillar of rock and slammed through its spine. Bone crunched, and blood sprayed. And Nezrin threw herself into a stop, swaying so hard she teetered backward onto her ass, a wordless cry on her lips, as the hatchling was hauled around the rock, flailing and shrieking. It went silent. And she had seen horrific things, things that had made her sick and kept her from sleep. And yet that baby Rook, terrified and pleading, in pain and dragged away, going silent. Nezrin whirled, feet slipping on the shale as she scrambled toward Kadara, toward Sartak, who beheld the hatchling being snatched behind that rock and screamed at Kadara to fly. The mighty Rook tried and failed to rise.
Fly!
Sartak bellowed. Slowly, so slowly, the Rook lumbered to her legs, her scraped beak dragging through the loose rock. She wasn't going to make it, wasn't going to get airborne in time. For just beyond the web-shrouded tree line, shadows writhed, scuttled closer. Nezrin sheathed her sword and drew her bow, arrow shaking as she aimed it toward the rock the hatchling had been hauled behind, then the trees 100 yards off.
Go, Kadara, Sartak begged. Get up!
The bird was barely in shape to fly, let alone carry riders. Rock clacked and skittered behind her, from the labyrinth of rock within the pass. Trapped. They were trapped. Falcon shifted in her pocket, trying to wriggle free. Nezrin covered him with her forearm, pressing hard.
Not yet, she breathed. Not yet.
His powers were not Lysandra's. He had tried and failed to shift into a Rook this week, but the large wolf was as big as he could manage. Anything larger was beyond his magic.
Kadara!
The first of the spiders broke from the tree line, as black and sleek as her fallen sister. Nezrin let her arrow fly. The spider fell back, screaming, an unholy sound that shook the rocks as that arrow sank into an eye. Nezrin instantly had another arrow drawn, backing toward Kadara, who was just now beginning to flap her wings. The Rook stumbled. Sartak screamed,
Fly!
Wind stirred Nezrin's hair, sending shards of shale skittering. The ground rumbled behind, but Nezrin did not dare take her eyes off the second spider that emerged from the trees. She fired again, the song of her arrow drowned out by the flap of Kadara's wings. A heavy, pained beat, but it held steady. Nezrin glanced behind for a breath, just one, just to see Kadara bobbing and waving, fighting for every wing beat upward through the narrow pass, blood and shale dripping from her. Right as a Karen Kui emerged from one of the shadows of the rocks high up the peak, legs bending as if it would leap upon the Rook's back. Nezrin fired, a second arrow on its tail. Sartak's. Both found their marks, one through an eye, the other through the open mouth of the spider. It shrieked, tumbling down from its perch. Kadara swung wide to dodge it, narrowly avoiding the jagged face of the peak. The spider's splat thudded through the maze of rock ahead. But then Kadara was up, into the gray sky, flapping like hell. Sartak whirled toward Nezrin, just as she looked back at the pine forest, to where half a dozen Karen Kui now emerged, hissing. Blood coated the prince, his every breath ragged, but he managed to grab Nezrin's arm and breathe.
Run.
So they did. Not toward the pines behind, but into the gloom of the winding pass ahead. Chapter 43. Without the brace, Kaol was given a black mare, Farasha, whose name was about as ill-fitting as they came. It meant butterfly, Irene told him, as they gathered in the palace courtyard 3 days later. Farasha was anything but. Yanking at the bit, stomping her hooves and tossing her head, Farasha savored testing his limits long before the desert-bound company finished gathering. Servants had gone ahead the day before to prepare the camp. He'd known the royals would give him their fiercest horse. Not a stallion, but one close enough to match it in fury. Farasha had been born furious, he was willing to bet. And he'd be damned if he let those royals make him ask for another horse, one that would not strain his back and legs so much. Irene was frowning at Farasha, at him, as she stroked a hand down her chestnut mare's night-black mane. Both beautiful horses, though neither compared to the stunning Asterian stallion Dorian had gifted Kaol for his birthday last winter. Another birthday celebration. Another time. Another life. He wondered what had happened to that beautiful horse, whom he had never named, as if he'd known deep down how fleeting those few happy weeks were. He wondered if it was still in the royal stables, or if the witches had pillaged him, or let their horrible mounts use him to fill their bellies. Perhaps that was why Farasha resented his very presence. Perhaps she sensed that he had forgotten that noble-hearted stallion in the north, and wanted to make him pay for it. The breed was an offshoot of the Asterians, Hasar had tittered, as she'd trotted past on her white stallion, circling him twice. The refined wedge-shaped head and high tails were twin markers of their fey ancestry. But these horses, the Muniki, had been bred for the desert climes of this land, for the sands they were to cross today, and the steppes that had once been the Khagan's homeland. The princess had even pointed to a slight bulge between the horse's eyes, the jibba, the marker of the larger sinus capacity, that allowed the Muniki to thrive in the dry, unyielding deserts of this continent. And then there was the Muniki's speed. Not as fast, Hasar admitted, as an Asterian, but close. Irene had watched the princess's little lesson, face carefully neutral, using the time to adjust where she'd strapped Kaol's cane behind her saddle, then fiddle with the clothes she wore. While Kaol was in his usual teal jacket and brown pants, Irene had forgone a dress. They'd swathed her in white and gold against the sun, her long tunic flowing to her knees to reveal loose, gauzy pants tucked into high brown boots. A belt cinched her slim waist, and a glinting bandolier of gold and silver beading sliced between her breasts. Her hair she'd left in her usual half-up fashion, but someone had woven bits of gold thread through it. Beautiful. As lovely as a sunrise. There were perhaps 30 of them in total. None people Irene really knew, as Hasar had not bothered to invite any of the healers from the Torre. Swift-legged hounds paced in the courtyard, weaving under the hooves of the dozen guards' horses. Definitely not Muniki, those horses. Fine indeed for guards. His men had received beasts nowhere near their quality. But without that awareness the Muniki possessed, as if they listened to every word spoken. Hasar signaled to Shen, standing proud at the gate, who blew a horn, and then they were off. For a woman who commanded ships, Hasar seemed far more interested in the equine heritage of her family's people, and seemed more than eager to unleash her skills as a Dargon rider. The princess cursed and scowled as the city streets slowed them. Even with word given well in advance to clear the path out of Antica, the narrow and steep streets checked their speed considerably. And then there was the brutal heat. Already sweating, Kaol rode beside Irene, keeping a tight leash on Farasha, who tried to take a bite out of not one but two vendors gawking from the sidewalks. Butterfly, indeed. He kept one eye upon the mare and the other upon the city passing by. And as they rode for the eastern gates into the arid, scrub-covered hills beyond, Irene pointed out landmarks and tidbits of information. Water ran through aqueducts wending between the buildings, feeding the houses and public fountains and countless gardens and parks scattered throughout. A conqueror might have taken this city 3 centuries ago, but that same conqueror had loved it well, treated it well and nourished it. They cleared the eastern gate, then passed down a long dusty road that cut through the sprawl beyond the city proper. Hasar didn't bother to wait, and launched her stallion into a gallop that left them waving away her dust. Caution, claiming he didn't want to eat her dust the entire way to the oasis, followed suit after giving a small smile toward Irene and a whistled command to his horse. Then most of the nobles and viziers, apparently having already taken bets, launched into various races at breakneck speed through towns cleared well in advance, as if this kingdom were their playground. Birthday party indeed. The princess had likely been bored and didn't want to look too irresponsible to her father, though he was surprised to find that Argon had joined them. Surely with most of his siblings away, he would have seized the chance to hatch some plot. But there was Argon, galloping close to caution as they blended into the horizon. Some of the nobility remained back with Kaol and Irene, letting the others put some miles between them. They cleared the last of the outlying towns, their horses sweat-soaked and panting as they ascended a large, rocky hill. The dunes began just on its other side, Irene had told him. They would water the horses here, then make the last leg of the trek across the sands. She was smiling faintly at him as they ascended the crag, taking a deer path through the scrub. Horses had trampled through here. Bushes were broken and shattered under careless riders. A few bushes even bore speckles of blood, already dried in the brutal sun. Someone should flay the rider who'd been so reckless with their mount. Others had reached the top of the crag, watered their horses, and moved on. All he saw of them were bodies and horseflesh disappearing into the sky, as if they simply walked off the edge of the cliff and into thin air. Farasha stomped and surged her way up the hill, and his back and thighs strained to keep seated without the brace to steady him. He didn't dare let her get a whiff of discomfort. Irene reached the summit first, her white clothes like a beacon in the cloudless blue day around them, her hair shining bright as dark gold. She waited for him, the chestnut mare beneath her panting heavily, its rich coat gleaming with hues of deepest ruby. She dismounted as he urged Farasha up the last of the hill, and then it knocked the breath from him. The desert. It was a barren, hissing sea of golden sand. Hills and waves and ravines, rippling on forever, empty and yet humming. Not a tree or bush or gleam of water to be seen. The unforgiving hand of a god had shaped this place. Still blew his breath across it, shifting the dunes grain by grain. He had never seen such a sight, such a wonder. It was a new world entirely. Perhaps it was an unexpected boon that the information they sought dwelled out here. Kaol dragged his attention to Irene, who was reading his face. His reaction. "Its beauty is not for everyone," she said. "But it sings to me, somehow. This sea where no ships would ever sail. Some men would look upon it and see only burning death. He saw only quiet, and clean, and slow creeping life. Untamed savage beauty."
"I know what you mean,"
he said, carefully dismounting from Farasha. Irene monitored, yet did nothing but hold out the cane, letting him find the best way to swing his leg over, back groaning and wobbling, and then slide down to the sandy rock. The cane was instantly in his hand, though Irene made no move to steady him while he finally released the saddle and reached for Farasha's reins. The horse tensed, as if considering lunging for him, but he gave her a no-nonsense glare, the cane groaning as he dug it into the rock beneath him. Farasha's dark eyes glowed as if she'd been forged in Hellas's burning realm. But Kaol stood tall as he could, didn't break her stare. Finally, the horse huffed, and deigned to let him haul her toward the sand-crusted trough that was half-crumbling with age. The trough perhaps had been here for as long as the desert had existed, had watered the horses of 100 conquerors. Farasha seemed to grasp that they were to enter that ocean of sand, and drank heartily. Irene led her horse over, keeping the chestnut a healthy distance away from Farasha, and said, "How are you feeling?"
"Solid,"
he said, and meant it.
"I'll be aching by the time we get there, but the strain isn't so bad."
Without the cane, he didn't dare try to walk more than a few steps. Could barely manage it. She still put a hand on his lower spine, then his thighs, letting her magic assess. Even with the clothes and the heat, the press of her hands left him aware of every inch of space between them. But others gathered around the ancient enormous trough, and so he pulled out of Irene's assessing touch, leading Farasha a safe distance away. Mounting the mare again, though...
Take your time,
Irene murmured, but remained a few steps away. He'd had a block at the palace. Here, short of climbing onto the precarious lip of the trough, the distance between his foot and the stirrup had never seemed so long, balancing on one foot while he lifted it, pushing down with the other to propel him up, swinging his leg around the saddle. Kaol went through the steps, feeling the motions he'd done 1,000 times before. He'd learned to ride before he was 6, had been on a horse nearly his entire life. Of course he'd been given a devil of a horse to do this with. But Farasha held still, staring toward the sifting sea of sand, to the path that had been trampled down the hill, their entry into the desert. Even with the shifting winds hauling the sands into new shapes and valleys, the tracks the others had left were clear enough. He could even spy some of them cresting hills and then flying down them, little more than specks of black and white. And yet he remained here, staring at the stirrups and saddle. Irene offered casually,
I can find a block or bucket.
Kaol moved. Perhaps not as graceful as he'd like, perhaps more struggling than he'd intended. But he managed, the cane groaning as he used it to push upward, then clattering to the rock, as he let go to grab the pommel of the saddle, right as his foot slid, barely, into the stirrup. Farasha shifted at his weight while he hauled himself higher into the saddle, his back and thighs barking as he swung his leg over. But he was up. Irene strode to the fallen cane and dusted it off.
Not bad, Lord Westfall.
She strapped the cane behind her saddle and mounted her mare.
Not bad at all.
He hid his smile, his face still overwarm, and nudged Farasha down the sandy hill at last. They followed the tracks the others had left slowly, the heat rippling off the sands. Up and down, the only sounds the muffled thumping of their horses and the sighing sands. Their party meandered in a long, snaking line. Guards had been posted throughout, standing with towering poles topped with the Coggin's flag and insignia of a dark running horse, markers of the general direction toward the oasis. He pitied the poor men ordered to stand in the heat for a princess's whim, but said nothing. The dunes evened out after a time, the horizon shifting to reveal a flat, sandy plain, and in the distance, waving and bobbing in the heat.
There we make our camp,
Irene said, pointing toward a dense cluster of green. No sign of the ancient buried city of the dead that Hisar claimed the oasis had grown over. Not that they expected to see much of anything from their vantage point. From the distance, it might very well be another 30 minutes, certainly at their pace. Despite the sweat soaking through her white clothes, Irene was smiling. Perhaps she too had needed a day away, to breathe the open air. She noticed his attention and turned. The sun had brought out her freckles, darkening her skin to a glowing brown, and tendrils of hair curled about her smiling face. Farasha tugged on the reins, her body quivering with impatience.
I own an Asterian horse,
he said, and her mouth curved in an impressed frown. Kaol shrugged.
I'd like to see how a Muniki measures up.
Her brows narrowed.
You mean?
She noted the flat, smooth spread of land between them and the oasis. Perfect for running.
Oh, I can't. A gallop?
He waited for the words about his spine, his legs. None came.
Are you afraid?
He asked, arching a brow.
Of these things? Yes.
She cringed at her mount, restless beneath her.
She's as sweet as a dairy cow,
he said of Irene's chestnut mare. Kaol leaned down to pat Butterfly's neck. She tried to bite him,